This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from our studios in central London, I'm Julian Marshall. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has arrived in Panama on his first overseas trip as America's top diplomat, and he'll certainly need all his diplomatic skills to explain why President Trump has threatened to seize control with force if necessary of the Panama Canal, the internationally used waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic to the Pacific. Mr. Trump made the threat in his inauguration speech last month. He claimed that Panama had breached the terms of its treaty with the US and Washington was losing out to China.
We have been treated very badly from this foolish gift that should have never been made. And Panama's promise to us has been broken. The purpose of our deal and the spirit of our treaty has been totally violated. American ships are being severely overcharged and not treated fairly in any way, shape, or form. And that includes the United States Navy. And above all, China is operating the Panama Canal. And we didn't give it to China. We gave it to Panama. And we're taking it back.
But Panama insists the canal is under its control, and if anything, the United States gets preferential treatment. Ilia Espino de Marotta is the deputy administrator of the Panama Canal Authority.
It's very important that it's known that the Panama Canal is run by Panamanians. We are an autonomous entity of the state. And I mean, I've been working in the canal for 39 years, so I can assure you that the Panama Canal is run by Panamanians and it's an autonomous entity of the country. I mean, we're a very transparent entity. You can see how much the tolls are. And actually, the U.S. military and auxiliary vessels get priority to come through the canal, and they don't have to pay a reservation. So on the contrary, if there is any country or state that gets favored, it's the United States, and it's because of the treaties. It was stated that they will have priority in passage, and they don't require a reservation, neither to pay for a reservation.
That was Ilia Espino de Marotta, the deputy administrator of the Panama Canal Authority. And Jaime Alaman is a former Panamanian ambassador to the United States and recently was a member of the country's Foreign Affairs Advisory Council. Firstly, what did he make of the bellicose language that President Trump had used last month? Was this any way to treat an ally?
Obviously, it's not. It's a bit disconcerting, but we know the style of President Trump, but it would not be something that we would enjoy having such a tense relationship, especially considering the fact that we are an unconditional U.S. ally in many regards, our biggest commercial partner. So it's not a well-received this type of approach, but there's still calm in the country, I would say, because we know what the aims of the United States, where their strategic goals are with regards to Panama. And we're optimistic that we will be able to talk things out in a civilized manner and reach a mutually satisfactory agreement which safeguards each country's best interests.
So what are the U.S. aims in Panama and specifically with reference to the Panama Canal?
Well, I think the talk that President Trump has made regarding the canal is not realistic. He knows very well that the canal is not subject to negotiation and is not subject to be delivered by Panama to the United States. And also, if there was a forceful attempt by the U.S., which is not going to happen, but if it were to happen and there would be opposition from everyone in Panama, there would be no cooperation whatsoever. And so that's not something that really scares us or concerns us too much. We know that that's just his bargaining position and that there are other things that are more of interest to the United States, particularly the ports. The ports is something that is symbolic in many ways, and having the presence of two ports, one at the Pacific entrance to the canal and the other one at the Atlantic entrance, run by a Chinese company, is of concern to the United States. The fact of the matter is that when the bid was made for those ports, it was won by Hutchinson Whampoa, which at the time was based in Hong Kong, I think it still is, and Hong Kong was a part of the United Kingdom. It was not a part of Communist China or the People's Republic of China. And now circumstances have changed. There's a lot more tension between China and the U.S., as everyone knows. And this is something that concerns the U.S., and we understand that concern.
So would Panama be prepared to renege on any agreement that gave control of those two ports to a Hong Kong-based company in order to satisfy the United States? Because what seems to be bugging Mr. Trump is what he sees as growing Chinese influence over the canal.
Yes, and I think his concerns maybe have some legitimacy. What Panama is doing is reviewing the agreement. There have been a lot of allegations about improper acts on the part of the Chinese company. I can ascertain whether they're true or not, but the Controller General is, at the moment, undertaking a very large review to see. This company has been very aggressive in objecting to the establishment of new ports in Panama, and they have used legal tactics to prevent the opening of new ports and also to attack companies that already operate in Panama. Those are the that's the impression that the people of Panama have. So I don't think anybody's going to shed any tears if the concession is revoked on a legal basis. Obviously, we can't do it forcefully or without a legal foundation, but this is not a company that is particularly well-loved by the Panamanians. So it's not as if the Chinese Hutchison solely controls the port activities in Panama, and they certainly don't control the operation of the Panama Canal. And I'm sure Mr. Trump is very clear on that, but for political purposes, he's claiming that the Chinese run the canal, but he knows perfectly well that that's not the case.
That was Jaime Alemán, former Panamanian ambassador to the United States. It's coming up for 2 years in Sudan since two rival warlords and their supporters started fighting each other. What began as a battle for control of the capital has become a battle for control of the entire country between the head of the army, General Burhan, and General Hemeti, who leads the Rapid Support Forces militia. And with each passing month, atrocities against the civilian population have mounted. Among the latest is the shelling on Saturday of a market in Omdurman, twin city of Khartoum, which has killed more than 50 people and injured dozens of others. The casualties were taken to El Nau Hospital in Omdurman, which was being visited at the time by Chris Lockyer, General Secretary of the medical charity MSF.
Well, the scenes in El Nau Hospital in Omdurman just yesterday were catastrophic. I mean, the emergency room was just full of patients needing urgent treatment. The outpatient department was full of walking wounded. There were more patients being brought in as I arrived, and there were dead bodies going in the opposite direction. Outside the morgue was a pile of dead bodies in body bags. And as I was there, I mean, obviously there were people wailing because of the loss of loved ones. There was also people walking around the emergency room checking on individual patients to see if it was one of their relatives that were lying there. So it was a scene of utter devastation and carnage.
So dozens of injured, with injuries consistent with shelling?
Yeah, what happened was a shell hit a marketplace, and some of the injured were as a direct consequence of that shelling. Other patients because of the chaos and the disruption in that marketplace. So it was a really, really horrific scene. All elements of society who were out shopping were part of the casualties yesterday. And so I've seen men, I've seen women, I've seen children in the last few hours who have massive trauma wounds, and they range from the walking wounded, so people who can be have simple bandages to stop the bleeding, to those who have had shrapnel wounds in their heads, to those who have lost limbs. So there's a whole range of people that have been affected, and a whole range of injuries that they've got.
And the hospital is able to offer what kind of treatment to the patients? I mean, I just wondered what sort of medicines are available at the moment.
Supplies are really lacking. There was rationing of paracetamol, so even basic painkillers were in short supply. And there's a desperate need for basic medical supplies such as gauze for stopping blood flow. At the same time, there was one patient there who had a broken leg, and instead of having sort of eight wraps of plaster of Paris around as we would normally have for a broken wound. They just had one because of the rationing of material there. So they were trying very, very hard, and there was a lot of amazing work going on in the circumstances. But it's when you get a mass casualty event like that, of which there have been several over the last few days in this vicinity and on both sides of the front line, any hospital would struggle with that.
A mass casualty event adding to presumably the kind of treatment that you offer on a day-to-day basis to patients coming in.
Yeah, we're working to be able to increase the capacity and support the increase in capacity when it comes to mass casualty events. But we're also supporting in hospitals for malnutrition, which we see rising above normal cyclical patterns, both here in the Khartoum area, but also around Sudan, including in Darfur.
Those scenes at the hospital yesterday, this happens, does it, quite regularly?
Yeah, I'm visiting for just a couple of days, visiting our team here. And so it was a very unfortunate timing to witness a horror such as this. This is, I think, the third time in the last couple of months where they've had to deal with a mass casualty event. And there are some hospitals which are just a few kilometers from here, which we can't yet reach because of the difficulty to cross front lines, where we have reports of other severe mass casualty events just in the last 4 or 5 days. And so we're really trying to be able to get to those places as well, to be able to support them.
Are you in touch with the combatants in any way?
Yes, we're in contact with both sides of this conflict. It's how we try and operate in any conflict around the world. In fact, one of the reasons I'm in Sudan at the moment is to be making and developing those contacts and discussing how we can operate in this very, very dynamic conflict, which is changing by the day. So as a matter of modality, we try and seek to be in contact with those who are fighting here and anywhere in the world.
I mean, it's obviously not your job to mediate in any way, but I mean, do you try to impress upon the combatants the consequences of their actions, such as you witnessed at the hospital yesterday?
Absolutely. And we want to be talking about the horrific things we're seeing. This war is a war on civilians. It has been going on for nearly 2 years now, in which the civilians have been clearly the main victims of this conflict, and whether that's through direct shelling that we saw yesterday or whether that's because of huge rates of malnutrition throughout Sudan, but particularly in Darfur. We want to speak to the combatants and tell them this is the consequence of your actions.
That was Chris Lockyer, General Secretary of the medical charity MSF, speaking to me earlier from Omdurman in Sudan. Coming up, celebrating the art of storytelling at a festival in Morocco. We'll take you there.
I stand up and say, ladies and gentlemen, assembled company, we are reclaiming the square for storytelling. The square was, for 1,000 years, had storytelling, and it was one of the most important parts of the square, apart from the 6,000 camels.
And the latest headlines from the BBC newsroom, Canada, Mexico and China have said they will retaliate against steep tariffs imposed on their goods by President Trump. Rwanda has accused foreign forces fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo of plotting to attack its territory. And Syria's new leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, is in Saudi Arabia, his first foreign trip since the toppling of the Assad regime. We'll have more on that later in this edition of NewsHour. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. The British government is introducing new laws to tackle the threat of child sexual abuse images generated by artificial intelligence. They include making the possession of the AI tools which generate the images and the manuals to use them illegal. Yvette Cooper is the UK's Interior Minister. This is what she told the BBC about the scale of the problem and what she wants to do to tackle it.
AI is now putting the online child abuse on steroids. It's escalating, industrializing the scale of some of this appalling abuse. You have perpetrators who are using AI to help them better groom or blackmail teenagers and children, distorting images and using those to draw young people into further abuse. We're bringing in new laws to outlaw the use of AI models to create and exploit child abuse images, and also much stronger penalties on those who are creating these forums to teach other people to use AI for abuse.
That was UK's Interior Minister Yvette Cooper, and on the line now, Dr. Alexandros Antonios, Senior Lecturer in Media Law at the University of Essex, who researches the area of online safety. And would you go along with the Minister? Is this a growing threat? Child sexual abuse images generated by AI.
Hello. Yes, I would agree. I suppose there is a history of harmful technology uses. We had the internet, video calls, computer-generated images that are all being exploited to create that sort of content. And we are now seeing, you know, another manifestation of that perpetual race to catch up with technology's uncompromising march. That sort of content rises exponentially, and it becomes increasingly indistinguishable from real imagery.
And there are no laws in place at the moment making this kind of activity illegal.
Well, I suppose these new measures complement the puzzle. There are another piece to complete the puzzle. We've got laws that criminalize those who exploit the tools. So, for instance, we've got those laws that target those who view and access such content. We have some laws that clarify the responsibilities of online platforms in facilitating the dissemination of such content. But we don't really have laws that ensure the accountability for those who create those tools and those technologies for illicit purposes. So on a first thought, this is a promising starting point, but without having seen the precise wording of the law.
This carries with it, it seems, an assumption that these AI images are actually generated here in the UK, but presumably this is a transcontinental activity.
That's right. There will be some enforcement challenges. There are questions about, you know, what sort of tools will be caught within that series of measures. So how do we define them? How easy it is to articulate offences that criminalise those fine-tuned models have been essentially created to generate that sort of content. But we also have, you know, larger concerns. Unlike past tools, AI now can generate vast amounts of material offline. Officers could...
Dr. Antonio, I didn't mean to break in there, but in fact, we are out of time. That was Dr. Alexandros Antonio, a senior lecturer in media law at the University of Essex. Giving up alcohol is a common New Year's resolution. Millions around the world will have just finished a month of abstinence, known as Dry January. But as well as cutting out what's bad for us, research suggests that switching to alcohol-free beer could have additional health benefits compared with other soft drinks or even water. And firms have also been working on making it taste better with alcohol-free beer, the fastest-growing sector of what was traditionally the alcoholic drinks industry. Marnie Chesterton has been finding out more, starting in Leuven in Belgium.
This is an experimental brewery that actually can create whatever type of beer we want to make. My name is David de Schutter, and I'm heading research and development globally for AB InBev. We're always pursuing a better beer, especially for no-alcohol beer.
David and his team use a newer innovation called vacuum distillation.
The boiling point of the alcohol reduces. Then you don't harm the beer.
Prost.
Prost. So it has been through the vacuum distillation, and then we applied our aroma technology to bring back the beer flavor to life. You need to add the gas as well back, so you need to recarbonate the beer.
But there is another way to make non-alcoholic beer, and that's to not brew the alcohol in the first place. We're in the lab of Kevin Verstreppen, world expert on yeast, at the University of Leuven and the Flanders Institute for Biotechnology.
And so in total we have something like 20, 25,000 different yeasts.
Kevin's lab studies yeast for multiple purposes, one of them being to make better yeasts for the beer industry. And so how do you make a non-alcoholic beer?
For that you use a different yeast, one that doesn't produce alcohol, but has a metabolism similar to humans. We also eat sugar, but we don't make alcohol, we make water and carbon dioxide. Once you take the alcohol out, you end up with quite a nutritious drink. Alcohol itself also contains quite a few calories. Alcohol-free beer has some antioxidants, has some vitamins, some lipids.
And is there anything specific coming from the yeast?
What the yeast will do is it will take the refined sugars and eat those. So it takes those bad sugars away for us. It's for sure more healthy than sugar-containing soda. It's a pretty good sports drink. I know that even the German Olympic team or the soccer team, I think at some point, was allowed to drink alcohol-free beers.
We checked. It was the Olympic team. And actually, it was thanks to the doctor for the German Olympic ski team who conducted a study on marathon runners, finding that non-alcoholic beer reduced inflammation and respiratory infections. Now, why would that be? Well, there seems to be one more thing that non-alcoholic beer can offer us.
I'm Claudia. I'm a nutritionist and I'm a professor of nutrition and metabolism at Nova Medical School in Lisbon, Portugal.
Claudia Marquez studies the effects of food and drink on our gut microbiomes.
So one group drink alcoholic beer and the other one drink non-alcoholic beer. It was one bottle of beer per day. And after 4 weeks, this consumption increased the diversity of microorganisms that we have in our gut. A good diversity is usually associated to health.
So what's in beer that's helping diversify our gut microbiomes?
Polyphenols can be responsible for these effects. Polyphenols are chemicals that we found in plants. We feed the good bacteria instead of feeding the bad bacteria. They can also have other properties such as anti-inflammatory effects.
We probably need more research looking into these polyphenols to really understand the health benefits of non-alcoholic beer. Claudia's study is just the beginning. Modern non-alcoholic versions are a better brew, taste-wise. They also have fewer calories than beer and offer the chance to socialise in a drinking culture without drinking pints of fruit juice or sodas. They might even have the edge over water, thanks to the polyphenols that feed your gut microbiome.
Bonnie Chesterton reporting. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. And storytellers from around the globe have broken a world record by telling their tales continuously for more than 3 days. Performers from 33 countries took part in the event in the Moroccan city of Marrakesh. They managed to go on for a total of 80 hours and 34 minutes. Our reporter, Richard Hamilton, was there.
This is the Jemaa el Fanar, the famous square right at the heart of the ancient Medina of Marrakesh. And it was here, 1,000 years ago, that storytellers began telling tales in the square. And this carried on for hundreds of years until, in the 1970s, as Moroccans got televisions, radios, then later the internet, social media, the young generation forgot about storytelling and it began to die out. But now, the Marrakesh International Storytelling Festival is trying to revive an interest in storytelling. As part of that, they're trying to break the record for the longest continuous storytelling session.
Bird's Nest spoke. Governor, I can only give you one advice. Be good. Just do good. And Bird's Nest said, Governor, a 5-year-old can understand this, but a 78-year-old still finds it difficult.
do not do what Wee Tom did. Wee Tom was grabbed by the shoe with no lace in it, and he went out of the window and up into the air. Hi, 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 hi.
My name is Brahim Daldali. I am a storyteller from Safru. A storytelling festival in Marrakesh has opened a big door for me to meet authors, to meet also academic people. So it's a huge opportunity for me. We teach young storytellers to be professional. So storytelling family starts growing.
I'm John Rowe, Artistic Director of the Marrakesh International Storytelling Festival.
How important is the festival in terms of reviving the tradition?
I prefer to call it a resuscitation because it never quite died, but it was in need of a little help. We're just one part of a process, I think, but a very important part. Bringing it back to the square, making it a spectacle again, because that was part of the problem. It was no longer a spectacle in the square. I stand up and say, ladies and gentlemen, assembled company, we are reclaiming the square for storytelling. The square was, for 1,000 years, had storytelling, and it was one of the most important parts of the square, apart from the 6,000 camels.
Report by the BBC's Richard Hamilton in Marrakesh. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Among the flurry of executive orders that President Trump signed last month, the day after taking office, was one calling for a 90-day pause on foreign aid programs. The order got less attention than some of the others he signed that day, but it may have much more far-reaching consequences. While later in January, the Secretary of State issued a directive that went even further, effectively freezing operations at the US Agency for International Development, or USAID. No new projects were to be started, no contracts were to be extended, and work was to be stopped on most existing programs. In a moment, we'll hear the way in which this US freeze on foreign aid has led to a disruption in the treatment of HIV/AIDS in South Africa. But first, let's get some clarity on that freeze itself, around which there is a certain amount of chaos and confusion. Apoorva Mandavilli is a global health reporter with the New York Times and has been covering the aid freeze from the start. And Apoorva, when was the start and what aid programs are affected?
Thanks for having me. The entire thing started on January 20th, which was essentially the beginning of the Trump administration. It was one of the first things he signed, as you pointed out, and it was sweeping. It seemed to include just about everything that the U.S. does abroad. And so people were extremely confused about what it actually included. And then the very next day, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said it wasn't meant to be destructive or punitive. And yet, I think that's exactly what it turned out to be. Over the next few days, people were told to stop working on every single thing that they did, medicine for things like HIV, malnutrition camps, you name it. And so all of a sudden, people didn't know exactly how to access the money. Everything was shut off. And so they had to start laying off their workers and everything ground to a halt.
So the people providing the money, providing the aid, were no longer doing their jobs.
They were told to stop doing their jobs. They actually received what's called stop work orders. They were told to stop doing everything they were doing, to stop distributing medicines, to stop diagnosing people, to stop even doing prevention work, anything and everything. And so people were actually told to go home. And at the same time, employees here in the U.S. at the CDC and at USAID were told not to talk to anybody. So if people abroad had questions, they had no one to ask.
So how much money is involved and directed to which parts of the world?
Well, so the entire aid budget is about $70 billion, which is about 1% of the the country's budget. So we're not talking about huge amounts of money for the US, but it's enormous amounts of money for a lot of these places. And a lot of the medical work that happens does happen in Africa and in some parts of Asia. And even within that, there's some variability. So you mentioned South Africa earlier. There, the HIV programs rely on US aid for about 20%. But then you look at a country like Mozambique, they rely on aid for about 80% of their HIV budget. So it really depends. But some countries are going to be just absolutely devastated by this.
But there has been some kind of reprieve, is that right? The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has signed a waiver. How does that work?
Yeah, so in that first week after the pause, there was this grinding to a halt. And so people were absolutely panicked and there was a lot of backlash. And they were told to stop distributing HIV drugs, and that got a bit of a backlash. And so on Tuesday, January the 28th, so it's 8 days after the initial pause, Secretary of State Marco Rubio issued this waiver. But it was quite vague. It said that they would now allow life-saving humanitarian assistance, including essential medicines. And of course, that sounds like now you can give medicines for lots of things. But because it didn't spell out exactly what that was, people were terrified to make the wrong move. And so even though it sounded like, for example, distributing HIV drugs was okay, no one did it. They just did not want to make a wrong move and then have everything get shut down later on. And so people did not distribute HIV drugs, even for children.
Apoorva, look, many, many thanks for giving us that clarity. That was Apoorva Mandavelli, global health reporter with the New York Times, who's been covering the aid freeze from the start. Well, among the programs affected is the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, or PEPFAR. So what impact has that had on HIV/AIDS treatment in South Africa? I've been speaking to Professor Ntobeko Ntusi, President and CEO of the South African Medical Research Council.
The recent disruption to these programs has had a significant impact immediately on operations on the ground. Just to give you an example of the scale of PEPFAR, for instance, so South Africa receives about 20% of the annual disbursement from PEPFAR, which comes to about $350 million. The PEPFAR program employs over 250,000 doctors in 55 countries and over 1 million nurses and community healthcare workers. And with the stop work orders received between the 24th and 27th of January, all these staff members were immediately told to cease operations, 15 to 20,000 of them based in South Africa. And this meant that patients primarily with HIV infections who need to receive life-saving antiretroviral therapy as well as other treatments could no longer access their therapies. And the same has been true for other programmatic care programs. And as you can imagine, this has caused a significant furor around the country. Many people have rallied to try and get the US administration to change its position. And on Friday, you will have heard that they've issued a waiver now saying that the continued treatment of HIV will now be permitted under US aid and PEPFAR programs.
So there was a brief interruption to the treatment that was available. And what were the consequences of that for the treatment of patients living with HIV/AIDS?
Patients with HIV need to take their antiretroviral therapy daily. And what this does is to keep the immune system functioning optimally and the levels of the virus in the body suppressed. And once you have an interruption in your treatment, the levels of the virus begin to increase. And this increases your risk of opportunistic infections and cancers. But most importantly, you need to sustain a steady level of the drugs in your system. And when these are dip below a critical threshold for sustained or repeated periods, you can then develop resistance to the antiretroviral therapy as the HIV virus mutates, resulting in decreased efficacy of the treatment.
So it'd be true to say that there are probably a lot of HIV/AIDS patients whose treatment has been compromised.
Indeed, yeah. Patients who needed a refill of their medication in the last week could not access services and could not receive treatment. My hope is that with the waiver issued on Friday, from tomorrow onwards, many of the services will be recontinued. But the concern, of course, is that we don't know what the long-term implications of the very America First anti-DEI policies from the new U.S. administration are going to be on these important global health programs.
Should South Africa be so reliant on foreign aid?
I mean, the simplistic answer would obviously to say no. And I think what this event in the last week has demonstrated quite flagrantly is that countries in the global south need to significantly diversify sources of funding, reduce their reliance on the US government, and have their own governments invest more substantially in care programs internally. And it's clear that they can no longer look to the White House for the kind of global leadership and support it has played. Their future really should lie in their own agency and development.
Professor Ntobeko Ntusi. The Grammys are happening tonight in Los Angeles. The Recording Academy Awards are the most prestigious in the music industry. But with Los Angeles still recovering from devastating wildfires, the build-up to the event has been scaled back. Here's our LA correspondent, Emma Vardy.
There's been an outpouring from the music industry in the wake of the fires.
This one's for you, Los Angeles! Yeah!
This week, artists including Dr. Dre and Billie Eilish were among a star-studded lineup at two benefit concerts in LA, with all the proceeds going to the rebuilding process.
We'll laugh again. We're going to listen to music again.
Billy Crystal, who lost his home in the Palisades fire, said LA will recover.
We're Los Angeles, one city, one heart. LA strong!
Usually, the week leading up to the Grammys are filled with lavish parties. But this year, they've been cancelled in favour of low-key events to help more money be directed to supporting those who lost their homes. At a brunch for people in the music industry, Danny Chavez, an artist manager, told me it's difficult to find anyone who hasn't been touched by the disaster.
I know multiple musicians who lost their gear, something as simple as that. I know stylists who work in the music who have lost their houses that had costumes and whatnot. I know musicians who are born and raised in LA who lost their house.
Eileen Kazarian, a creative director, said holding the awards so close to the disaster could be a bad look for the industry.
I actually don't think that the Grammys should be happening. It's just very weird to me that there are going to be celebrities, you know, walking on the red carpet wearing very expensive clothes while people in other parts of the city are suffering and whose livelihoods have been destroyed.
Outside LA's crypto arena, the final touches are being put in place for the ceremony. And the red carpet has been rolled out in front of me here, and I can see workers carrying bottles of champagne into the stadium. Now, there have been doubts over whether the Grammy should happen at all, but the Recording Academy has justified its decision, saying the evening will double as a charitable event to raise money and honour the emergency teams who risk their lives.
This ain't Texas.
So perhaps the biggest question is whether Beyoncé will finally win an award for Best Album. As the most nominated artist in Grammy's history, but having repeatedly missed out on this accolade.
And I love you, it's ruining my life.
But she's up against Taylor Swift, who's won this category now four times.
You got a lot of nerve, don't you, baby?
And Post Malone with eight nominations. It's also tipped to be a night of success for up-and-coming artists with a number of nominations for Chappell Roan and Charlie XCX. While fires continue to burn across LA County, for now the show will go on. and the music industry is keen to strike the right note.
Emma Vardy reporting here on NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Ahmed al-Sharaa has come a long way since the ousting of President al-Assad last December. He was the leader of the Islamist forces that got rid of Assad, and he swiftly assumed the leadership of Syria. This week, he also became Syria's interim president. And today, he's in Saudi Arabia, where he's met the country's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Let's speak to the BBC's Lina Sinjab in Damascus. And Lina, why has Ahmed al-Sharaa chosen Saudi Arabia as the first country to visit?
Well, basically, this is also a message in the region and a message to internally to ally, Syria with, seen country as the most powerful and the most influential and strong financially. He is seeking, recognition. He's getting this recognition, but also he's seeking financial support to rebuild the country, and who is in better place to give support to Syria rather than Saudi Arabia. And being welcomed by the Crown Prince, a de facto prince leader in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, is also a strong message to welcome him into the Arab world. This visit comes after, the leader of Qatar, bin Hamad, also visited Damascus. So two strongest countries in the region, two of the most richest one in the region, having, strong relations with Syria is what al-Sharaa is after, to be able to rebuild the country and gain credibility internally.
Mr. al-Sharaa now calls himself interim president. Does he speak for Syrians? Are they likely to be happy about this seeming new alliance with Saudi Arabia?
I think there are no unified views here in Syria, whether they accept him as a president or they are not in terms with this appointment. However, the wider majority of Syrians, especially after the speech that he made addressing the nation, the first one that he addressed the nation, people were taken by surprise about how, comprehensive, inclusive, and, recognizing people's agony and people's hopes. So really, people were counting on this, and they felt that he's on the right track. They're now watching his actions, and this alliance with Saudi Arabia, after Saudi Arabia also changed and opened up from conservative and hardline Islamist to an open society. Many in Syria would like to see a model like that, because they are worried he is Islamist. He was in Al-Qaeda in the past. They are worried that to have an Islamist rule in Syria. So if this is the model that he's following, it's Saudi's model that is opening up, Syrians would feel more assured about it. But it's a time of accountability. It's a time of watching their actions and how they are implementing it on the ground.
Lina, look, many thanks for that. That was the BBC's Lina Sinjab in Damascus. Tarot, the set of playing cards illustrated with mysterious symbols, has been popular for hundreds of years. The cards have been also widely used to tell people's fortunes, and now they're having a cultural revival. Fashion houses, think Dior, writers and artists have recently been turning to tarot to spark their imagination and start conversations. The BBC's Robin Banerjee has been along to the Warburg Institute in London to see a show on the history of these mysterious cards with the Institute's director.
So I'm here at the Warburg Institute with Bill Sherman. Bill, we are at the beginning of tarot here, aren't we, in this part of the gallery? What are we looking at?
Literally. It starts in Renaissance Italy, like many good things, and it has nothing to do with magic. Here we have four cards from about the 1450s.
They're beautiful, and they're like sort of miniature Renaissance paintings. And they're also a lot bigger than people would normally associate with playing cards.
They are. They're probably twice as big.
What are we looking at here? There are four cards, and they're cards from a card game. That's right, isn't it?
Tarot is still a game played with cards. in similar structure to the modern playing cards that most of us use when we're playing anything like poker or blackjack. However, you have the addition of 21 symbolic cards. Those cards are called trumps, and they trump other cards.
Where are you taking us to now?
I'm taking you to late 18th century France, because what happens, remarkably enough, is a card game suddenly becomes occult. And in the 1780s, there was a great obsession with recovering putative connections to ancient Egypt. So this lineage, all the way back to the ancient world, is invented at a table by a Freemason named Court de Gabelin. And Court de Gabelin basically says, watching these people play this card game, he suddenly realized that they preserved and captured an ancient wisdom tradition stretching all the way back to ancient Egypt.
It's hand-colored, is it? And it's got some of the cards that I think even those of us who don't spend our days playing tarot are familiar with. There's Death with his scythe. There's the Hermit carrying a lamp. What else is there, Bill?
My favorite. There's the Wheel of Fortune card, which is always there as well. And it's a unique survivor of, as I said, the first deck used for divination.
We've come to the final room now. It's a small little room within the exhibition. And it's full of, well, these are more like cards.
What we tried to assemble here is about 10 of the most interesting and provocative uses of tarot by artists and activists today. Here, for instance, we have the Black Power Tarot, has figures from African American convention and mythology.
Tina Turner is now the Force. She's gripping a lion. We've got James Brown as L'Amoureux, the lovers. He's between two young ladies.
Tupac,
he's hanging down.
Hanged man.
Yeah, Tupac is the hangman, and he's still sagging his jeans, even though he's hanging upside down.
This deck below here, the so-called lockdown tarot, made during lockdown, has what is probably now, at least this week, my favorite tarot card, which is the Trump. So Donald Trump himself is represented as a Trump card, and he is the king of vaccines.
And that was Bill Sherman, director of the Warburg Institute in London, talking to the BBC's Robin Banerjee about the history of tarot playing cards. And that's it from this edition of News Hour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to
speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.